Well, I hope you're finding this session fruitful, that you are finding some ease and perhaps some insight as we kind of weave this traditional practice of sitting on a cushion in a group with other people, weaving this with our daily life, the kind of life that we live at home, and finding that they do, in fact, or can kind of come together in a way that is harmonious and offers us a kind of compassionate way of being at home by ourselves, knowing that although we're sitting perhaps in a room by ourselves, we are actually sitting with 30, 40 more people at the same time. Last night, Kate brought in, I think it was last night, one of the more unusual paramitas, or one that's not on the list of six. And tonight, I'd like to talk about pranidhana paramita, that is on that same list that Kate mentioned, that list of 10, which is also a pretty traditional list. But the Mahayana tradition tends to use and favor the one of six paramitas. So Kate talked about bala paramita, or the perfection of spiritual power. But tonight, as I said, I want to talk about the pranidhana paramita. And pranidhana in Sanskrit means aspiration or vow. In one of the Buddhist dictionaries that I checked, pranidhana was defined as a firm resolve, earnest wish, or prayerful vow that carries with it the power to accomplish its positive purpose. And there were other meanings listed as well. But it seems pretty clear that in the Mahayana tradition, it's often used to often refers to dedicating oneself to the bodhisattva path. In other words, living those bodhisattva vows. And I'll touch base on those in just a few moments. But those are the same vows that we say after every Dharma talk. Tonight, however, I'd like to look at this paramita of aspiration or vow in a little bit broader way, and to see how it may inform ways that we can bring the other paramitas that we've been talking about deeply into our lives. Now, the practice of, or the act of vowing, may strike you as a little bit old-fashioned, like kind of writing letters and sending them by snail mail, right? People don't actually make vows that much anymore. It's a little bit, perhaps, quaint. Our modern culture has largely lost the custom, I think, of making very strong promises or giving voice to our deep aspirations in the presence of others. So other than wedding vows and the promise to affirm the truth or swear an oath in court, maybe the citizenship ceremony, the only other time I can really think of vows as having that kind of public power is in perhaps at an AA meeting or some other similar organization. We've become shy. We've become shy about stating out loud our intentions, our deep intentions, our resolutions, our promises that have come from our heart. And that's really, I think, unfortunate. As vows can give direction to our lives, and they give us patience in the face of obstacles. So I'm going to be using the word vow rather than aspiration, although, and there's other ways to translate the pranidhana word, of course. And I realize there's a number of words with kind of overlapping meanings, like, as I mentioned earlier, promise, intention. So I'd like to clarify what I mean by vow so that we have a shared understanding. And I hope this shared understanding will help us when we consider how vows are used and practiced within our Buddhist tradition. So the English word vow is a cognate with the Sanskrit vagat. And vagat means one who offers a sacrifice. And it's clear vows do entail sacrifice. A vow is an expression of what matters most to us, an intention that is born, I believe, from our deepest values. One Zen teacher uses the expression, the heart's deepest aspiration. That's a vow, the heart's deepest aspiration. At times in life, we are struck with a profound yearning to express our life deeply and fully in a certain way. And the yearning can perhaps slowly build or suddenly appear, but it comes from the heart, from our lived experience, rather than some kind of, you know, intellectual understanding or something we've been told by others. So here's an example. My mother, when she was a little girl, struggled with her own mother's sharp criticism and kind of tight-fistedness, and decided she would never inflict either of those on her own children. So it was a childhood vow, one that was a force throughout her life, because she was not tight-fisted with her children. And she did not often speak with sharp criticism. Children make vows. Maybe not well articulated, but vows that will shape how they grow up and the kind of life they begin to live. In his book, Taking Our Places, Zokitsu Norman Fisher writes of one of his childhood vows that arose in for him as he sat in synagogue, in a classroom in the synagogue, learning the sad but also very inspiring stories of the Jewish martyrs. And this is what Norman wrote. I felt myself sitting in my seat at that moment as though it were an eternal moment. And I thought, I will be like that too. I will never give up what I am, never give up what I know to be so, because someone tries to force me to. I felt that because of what people before me had endured in being true to their deepest identities and commitments, I too would endure and remain steadfast in their honor and in their name. As a Jewish child listening to a Jewish tale, I felt a vow come upon me to hold fast to being a Jew no matter what. A vow I have always kept in my heart, despite the fact I have practiced Buddhism for so long. Perhaps you too have a vow that was inspired by something you read or someone you knew during childhood. The stories that are shared amongst the family or religious community, as the example for Norman, they can be one very powerful source for children. So it's not unusual for children to make vows, sweeping deep promises that will take many years, if not a lifetime, to fulfill and complete. And it can be like my mother's vow, to be something that is not wanted, to steer away from something, a vow not to act or be in a certain way. One of my own childhood vows was not to cause fear in others, because I was so fearful of my father's sudden anger. Not always successful at that, but that was my vow and shaped my life. Chan Chosen Bays, a Zen teacher in Oregon and also a physician, a doctor, who worked with abused children, has written about children who have made vows to never drink alcohol, to never hit their own children, etc. very poignant, very moving. So vows can also arise early in life when they're inspired by others. Someone either directly or indirectly inspires us, and we aspire to be like them. Perhaps we wished to emulate a superhero and always be brave and strong, or maybe we have been inspired by someone noble when we read about some great heroic feat that they accomplished. Or maybe it's more mundane. When I was 20, I lived for a year at the home of my Japanese Aikido teacher in a small city in Japan. And he was relatively poor, living off donations from his students, and he had no savings. The attached apartment where he and his wife lived had three small rooms and a small hallway where the kitchen was. But during that year that I lived with them, he fed me, he took me to restaurants and coffee shops when he had any money, he made sure I had medical attention, and housed me for over a year. And yet, during that time, he refused to take any money. When I started to make a little bit of money from side jobs teaching English conversation, and really, I wasn't really teaching, I would just sit down, have coffee with somebody, and we would talk in English a little bit, and they'd pay me a bunch of money. Anyway, when I got a little bit of money that way, I had to slip my contribution into the general donation box for the teacher. And at that time, you know, during that year, I was very grateful. But I didn't consciously make any kind of vow. It was a number of years later that I discovered a vow within me, a vow of open-handedness and of sharing. My Aikido sensei had created in me, or inspired in me, a vow of generosity, which, as we know from our study, is the first paramita, right? The vow of generosity. So I would like to suggest that vows are expressions of what matters most to us, as I've said earlier. And vows have no clear ending. They are limitless in scope and can be a powerful source of energy for us. Unlike a simple promise or a resolution to meet a certain goal, vows can be held and practiced but never, never fully completed. And it's this quality, I think, that really gives vows the energy to propel us forward and to shape our actions. And this, I think, is the traditional understanding of vows, what vows are. Because, like, you know, for example, in the wedding vow, as it's written in the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, which I have on my bookshelf because my grandmother gave it to me when I was a lad going to confirmation class. And in that, it's written like this: to have and to hold from this day forward, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and cherish till death do us part. So in this way, I think a vow is different from a goal, right? It's not, doesn't say to love and hold and cherish as long as we're both healthy and doing well. There's no end until the very end, right? When we all check out from this world. So another example may be a goal may be to become a doctor. But a vow would be to alleviate the suffering of others. And so, yes, you become a doctor, but your vow to alleviate the suffering of others continues endlessly. And certainly the four great bodhisattva vows that we recite after every formal Dharma talk are expressions of this great, vast limitlessness, right? Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. The other thing about vows is they are I think, profound acts of imagination and of courage. Vows can arise out of a longed for and an imagined world or an imagined life. A world perhaps without prejudice, hunger, cruelty, drug abuse, homelessness. So some problem or suffering moves us, touches us, and we deeply consider it, hold it in our hearts. And maybe then we imagine a time, a place, a world, a life without that misery. So a vow is what shifts those musings, that contemplation, into the driving force of our life. To vow is to imagine a different course, a different way of being in the world. And it requires great courage, because vowing may set us on a course of life beyond what we desire or can even control. At times, it will run counter to our apparent self-interest and force us to make better decisions, or pardon me, to make difficult decisions. Remember that for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health goes the traditional wedding vow. So can we stay the course when our spouse or partner is diagnosed with Alzheimer's or cancer? Can we share and practice generosity at a time when we ourselves feel we have very little? Can we be kind and open-hearted to others when we ourselves are kind of struggling with pain and perhaps ill? Vows create opportunities for self-transcendence, going beyond what you consider your limits. And self-transcendence always involves hardship. So to me, this means that while I will never be free from life's challenges and hardships, sickness, old age, and death being some of the examples that we're familiar with, my vows will help overcome the dismay and despair that may arise as I meet the various adversities of this life. Now, of course, not all vows are wholesome. Some vows arise out of anger, hurt, greed, confusion. The vow to outdo a competitor, to become filthy rich, to get back at the person who hurt you no matter what. Those vows also can become the driving force of our lives. But I don't really think those are vows. At least I don't call them vows. I think of them as curses. Because as curses, they do not lead to openness, intimacy, to moving beyond a constricted view of the self. They lead in the exact opposite direction, to more suffering, more constriction, more pain, because they always isolate. They close us down. They lead us to the hell realm. So, good vows and not so good, or curses. So now let's kind of shift a little bit and consider vows a little more from the perspective of the Buddhist tradition. Buddhist history is full of vows taken by practitioners over the centuries, and all of the archetypal bodhisattvas proclaim their practice in terms of vows. So, for example, the vows of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, includes the vow never to rest until she has freed all sentient beings from delusion. Or another example is the Bodhisattva Kshitagarbha, the earth treasury bodhisattva, or in Japanese known as Jizo. For those of you who've been to Japan, I've seen Jizo statues everywhere, right? He appears as a monk. And among his vows, his vows include taking responsibility for the instruction of all beings in the six realms until the next Buddha arrives, the Maitreya Buddha, right? So he says, oh, look, I'm going to handle all the instruction. So all of the Buddhist texts, all the Dharma talks you're hearing, they're actually coming from Kshitagarbha Bodhisattva. He just kind of manifests himself within various teachers and gets these books printed for your benefit. That's his job. But his other job, his other vow, is a vow not to achieve full Buddhahood until all the hells are empty, to save every being who is in any hell realm. So the next time you find yourself in a hell realm, right? Like, what would be a hell realm? Traffic at gridlock. You're stuck there in a hot day. Or the hell realm of deep anger. You should know that you have a powerful bodhisattva at your side. Ask for help. In general, Buddhist practitioners of all schools use their vows as a kind of compass, a way to kind of stay on the path. You may not know where you're ultimately headed. In fact, none of us know where we're ultimately headed or if we'll ever get there. But your vows tell you what direction to keep moving in. Just keep practicing. Just keep moving. Just keep returning to compassion, to open-heartedness. In the Zen tradition, following one's vows in every moment is seen as the path itself. This central power, central essence of vows and the bodhisattva practices of the paramitas in the Zen tradition is really beautifully expressed in a very simple Japanese saying. Gosho no bonpo, gassho no basatsu. And Shohaku Okumura, a Zen teacher that Kate and I first started practicing with, in his book, Living by Vow, translates this as, ordinary people are those who live being pulled by their karma. Bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. So karma, of course, is a topic for another time, but here I think we consider karma as our conditioning. Do you want to live your life led by your conditioning, pulled by your conditioning? Or do you want to live a life led by your vows, by your deepest aspirations? So vows, I think, can be strong answers to the questions we all ask of ourselves at some point in our journey. Am I content to spend my life comfortable and simply entertained? How do I want my life to matter? Zoketsu Norman Fisher has written, vowing is like liberation from whim and weakness. It creates possibilities that would not occur otherwise, because when you are willing to stick to something, come what may, even if from time to time you don't feel like sticking to it, a magic arises, and you find yourself living and doing noble things you did not know you were capable of. Isn't that true? Don't we all have some experience of a deep vow, commitment, or promise that has taken us far beyond ourselves? Deep vows that live in, at the very center of our lives. Our Zen tradition has many examples of teachers and practitioners who have lived by vow. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit because I'm realizing I don't want to, I'm going to run out of time here a little bit if I don't. There is one famous Japanese Zen teacher who, he died in 1984, named Nakagawa Soen Roshi. He was one of the first Japanese Zen teachers to teach Western students. And among his students were some of the most influential teachers now living in the West, like Robert Aiken, who has now died, Philip Kaplow, Maureen Stewart, and others whose books you may have read. Soen Roshi wrote this haiku. Endless is my vow under the azure sky, boundless autumn. For Soen Roshi, this haiku was his vow to help all awaken. And one result is that he was able to transmit the Zen Buddhist teachings from Japan to the Western world, teaching both ordained and lay people. Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, right, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, gave up his comfortable temple and position in Japan to travel to America and spend the rest of his life establishing Soto Zen practice here. He often talked about the Bodhisattva vows and their importance in practice. They were, he said, the primary reason that he spent the rest of his life teaching and supporting his students in America. His personal vow was to help produce determined practitioners who are upright in their practice and in Zen life. And we, you and I, are the fruit of his deep vow. And one more person that I'll mention is Dayan Katagiri Roshi, who came from Japan to help Shinryu Suzuki Roshi at San Francisco Zen Center, and then later became abbot of the Minnesota Zen Center. He established that. And he died in 1990, but there are several of his books, of his talks, that have now been published. But he also wrote poems. And the poem I'd like to read to you is called A Peaceful Life. And Norman, Zokitsu Norman Fisher, would, when he got together with his ordained students, when they were going to study together, they would always recite this poem in the group. So I'm just going to read it now. Peaceful life. Being told that it is impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it is possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. But whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. Being asked, what is unfitting? I don't know what it is. But my heart knows somehow. I feel irresistible desire to know. What a mystery a human is. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. From my eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become a Buddha. But this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells myself, yes, I will. Just practice right here, now, and achieve continuity endlessly, forever. This is the living vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. So this is a poem about saying yes, of course, to our lives, to the mystery, the messiness, the love, the impossibility of being a human being. And the poem, I think, goes on to present and encourage that we live with a vow. Or more strongly, we live a life of vow. stronger than intention, stronger than a promise, a vow to live a peaceful life, to help others live peaceful lives, endlessly, forever. So, what vows do you hold? What are your deepest aspirations, your deepest intentions? At some point, maybe before the end of this session, during the free time, I hope you will take a few moments to articulate your vows. Think about what they are. Maybe write them down. Say them out loud as you walk in a forest. Say them to the sky and the earth. Deeply become intimate with them. And then let these vows, your vows, carry you through the messiness of this life.